interview with Elmer Lower, L-O-W-R-E-R, former president of ABC News, and John Hilbert, H-I-L-B-E-R-T, graduate student, and David Culbert, C-U-L-B-E-R-T, September 12th, 1980. What I want to, in a sense, do is get a twofer out of you, which is in part to ask you some questions relating to David Douglas Duncan and coverage at KSON in 1968, and then to ask you something about your own involvement in as the referee for the second of the Kennedy-Nixon debates in 1960.
Not referee, timekeeper.
Timekeeper. So I would say we can begin with whichever subject.
Go ahead. Well, Duncan's the easiest to get rid of.
Okay, fine. What I would like you to do is just tell me something about what you were doing in 1968, how you knew Duncan, and how he came to hire him to cover Vietnam for you.
Well, Dave Duncan is an old friend. I worked with him when we were both at Life magazine in the late 1940s and early 1950s. We worked in Bangkok together and worked in Japan and Korea the first part of the Korean War when it broke out on June 24th, 1950. So I had known him, and also we both happened to come from Kansas City, although we didn't know each other there. But so when I went into television, Dave used to come to see me quite often when he'd be in town in New York, and I was always trying to get him interested in doing something for television, but he was very uneasy about taking up a new medium. One time, my boss at NBC said, "Next time you are talking to Duncan, tell him to name his story that he'd like to do abroad, and we'll finance it. Produce a program for NBC." So he and I were out having a drink one afternoon. It was a 6D. You know what a 6D is? A 6D is David Douglas Duncan's delicious dairy drink. He's a teetotaler. Doesn't smoke. He was raised in Christian Science. He doesn't follow it. Does in those respects, but I mean he informally doesn't. At any rate, he doesn't drink at all. I've never known him to take a drink of alcohol. Very fine, very clean-living fellow. At any rate, we were at Schraff's having a little milkshake, and I sprung this on him, and I said, "Well, Dave," he said, "well, I don't know." I said, "Well, think it over and come back." Well, he never mentioned it again, even to this day. And that's an opportunity most people would jump at, you know. That was probably in about 1960. So then he would come in to see me occasionally, and I don't know, when he had a book coming out, I would try to introduce him to somebody who had an interview show, you know, so he could get some publicity for his book, Yankee Nomad, or one of his Picasso books. God, he's prolific, you know, manufactures his own books too, you know, so he doesn't have any middleman's profit. He gets them printed in Holland or in Switzerland, where they really do a beautiful job of printing them. But this time, he did come to me, and it was after I had gone to ABC. I went there on August 21st, 1963, as president of ABC News. So it was, that could have been in about 1966 or 67. That'd be about right. KSON? When was KSON? Was KSON after Ted?
Well, before and after, but he went out there in February, late January of 68.
Was that when it was? Yeah. Yes, that's right, because I think I was there about the same time, but missed him. At any rate, I suppose he must have come to me then in the fall of 1967, and he proposed this idea that he go out there and shoot combination for Life and for ABC News. George Hunt was the managing editor of Life magazine at that time. I knew George when I worked there. George was also an old Marine from World War II. And so Dave wanted to do the both of them, and so I talked to George on the phone about it, and our business people talked to the Life business people about it. And Duncan is a pretty good businessman. He sort of poses as an artist, but he's quite a good businessman too. And he wasn't bashful in asking for money. I think he got $100,000 out of us and $100,000 out of Life, plus his expenses, I think. he went out there and worked for both magazines. I guess we got two programs out of it. In television, we sort of think in terms of program costs, and we had a program at that time which was devoted entirely to the Vietnam War. I think we called it Scope.
Yep, that's right.
And it had several different names, and I was trying to locate what name it was at that time. It ran for about 110 weeks, and wasn't always shot in Vietnam. It could be a debate in Washington over the Vietnam War, whatever. It was a Sunday afternoon program, probably didn't get too big an audience, but at any rate, we thought, well, we got, 500,000 Americans out there, so we think we should do this. And so we figured if we could get two programs, that show had a budget of about $30,000 a week, and so we figured we could rationalize it some way. So he did go out there and came back with stuff. We had a problem with Dave on this. Our producers had a problem with him. Dave's not a television guy. He's a still picture man. And he's a very good one. And his idea of using a still picture on television is to put it on an easel and admire it. And our producers are educated in how you make something move, and how you move a show along, and how you keep something interesting enough that people want to twist the dial to something else. But he would like to show off all his pictures in the Museum of Modern Art, which of course won't pay him $100,000 to do that. So I remember the guy that we had producing the show at the time, his name was Sandy Goodman. Sandy had a little trouble there, and he knew Dave was a friend of mine. He was sort of afraid to deal with him harshly. If it had been anybody else, or if the guy hadn't been a friend of mine, I think he would have not given him much time at all. So we did use a couple of shows, and they turned out pretty well. I don't think they were sensational. But.
Do you get any audience response to having a well-known photographer?
No, I can't remember any.
But you didn't have really a very large viewing audience in 68, did you?
Well, ABC compared to no. Well, it depends on what time of day you mean. But the answer, probably in everything except sports, would have been no. Well, Tuesday night was a good ABC night. That was when we were carrying The Fugitive. That was 10 to 11 on Tuesday night. And ABC's Class A program schedule, primetime, was not terribly good in 1968. But this was, regardless of that, this was in real, real fringe time.
Well, you also ran
Sunday afternoon.
Okay, I know it's about
and many of the stations would have delayed it too. God knows when, what hour, I say it's like the UHF in Baton Rouge, which was the ABC affiliate at that time. Who knows when they would have played it.
Right. But you also ran the two programs of Duncan's on primetime as part of the evening ABC News, because that's where I first, I mean, I have transcripts of these shows. Yeah. And
excerpts.
Yeah, you use part of that.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay. That's beside the scope. But the scope carried the budget. We couldn't, for the evening news, if that had been, the evening news at that time didn't have a budget for a project like this. But the evening news could use some part of it, you see. They might be billed $5,000 out of that for $7,000 or whatever. And it would be good promotion for the Scope on Sunday. It would be a tie at the end, Frank Reynolds, or whoever it was at the time, would say, and this whole story will be seen on Sunday on Scope.
Well, and with this result, did you figure, geez, you were lucky that you didn't have these opportunities too often and you go bankrupt, or was there any move to say, gee, this is really unusual to use a still photographer and someone who's got something of a name, and maybe we should try this innovation in some other way?
It honestly didn't create very much of a splash.
Okay.
That might have been due to the fact that we weren't a terribly... We were building at that time. Might have been due to the fact it was on Sunday afternoon when probably not too many people saw it. But I don't really think that he blazed any new trails in this. I don't think it was a very innovative use of his pictures. And I think that resulted, that was the result of him and the producers not seeing eye to eye on the thing. He didn't know enough to produce the show. And we knew he didn't know enough, and we wouldn't have let him have the whole production responsibility in any event. And the producers, you know, got the best they could out of him. We did interview him, too. I remember that. I think John Scali interviewed him. Is that true? Is my memory correct?
That may be. The network show uses Duncan's as a voiceover.
Do they? Yeah. Well, that, on the network, on the news, that would be the way they'd do it, yeah. Because it would take too much time to sit him down in the studio and interview him. But I remember one in which Scali did the interviews. And I think that was Kaysan. I thought he made two trips to the Far East for us.
He may have. Yeah. I only know the coverage in 68.
So. Yeah. Then, the next time I was aware of him, he was working for NBC at the Republican Convention in Miami Beach in 1968. Doing still pictures for them. Shad Northshield, who was a friend of mine, who's now with CBS, and that time was the convention producer for NBC, hired him to do a still picture feature every night. NBC then was involved in tonnage coverage of conventions, as they still are to a certain extent, more so than the others. And so they would come on 7:30, and you know the convention backs and fills for hours, so or color guards coming in, stuff like that. And they would put Dave on with a feature every night, and I think they were moderately interesting. It was a good thing to do when you've got a lot of time to fill. It was a different kind of thing. I don't think they showed as much imagination. I don't think we did. As when, say, ABC Sports uses a guy like Bob Rieger for still photos on sports things. True, with sports you got a little more to work with, be a little flashier with it, not hemmed in so much with the facts. And then also Dave, down that convention, Dave talked his way into Nixon's hotel suite at the time when they were calling the roll. Balloting for Nixon for president on the Wednesday night of 1968 convention in Miami Beach. And he got a lot of pretty good still pictures of the Nixon family. There was a pool live camera in there, I believe, which shot some things, and Duncan was the only still man. He talked his way in.
Let me ask you one other question about Vietnam, and that also concerns the 68 period. Photograph, I'm sure you know, of General Loan blowing the brains out of a Viet Cong sympathizer. Well, as you also know, ABC had a camera crew standing there, as well as NBC, and ABC got part of that execution scene. And do you recall any decisions that you, as president, made regarding whether to show that or getting any commentary of any sort?
We didn't have the footage. Our cameraman there that day, was a local. And he was so afraid of this general, this police chief, he's afraid if he took that picture that the guy would blow his head off too. We didn't have an American, a Western cameraman on the job that day. So this guy shot everything right up to that point and then turned his camera off and picked up after the coup de grace. So what we did for coverage of it was we ran our film and the point, but this young man had blank. We used the AP still photo and then resumed. That's all we had to use. This guy's frightened to death. He's afraid he'd be killed too for having taken the picture. The Western cameraman kept rolling.
And CBS missed the story.
No, ABC.
Yeah, but CBS was not there. They did not get that
story.
They
weren't there? Was that only an NBC show? What?
Yeah. Really? And, yeah. So you got more than that.
Is that right? No, I didn't. Yeah.
But do you recall anybody, in retrospect, this is some of the most dramatic footage of the whole war, and do you recall at the time having any feelings about it? We've interviewed Chad Northshield, and Chad said that he was very concerned as producer about how much blood to show when the blood comes spurting out of the head. You were in a different executive position than over in another network. Do you?
Well, I didn't. Whatever we had to deal with, I don't think we had any big discussion of it, of whether to use it or not. See, as we missed the coup de grace, we had no blood spurting out. We had a gruesome still photo, slightly different. Different degree, certainly.
I could well imagine that the primary thing you were feeling was chagrin over, damn it, how come the guy gets this close and
Then I felt, I felt for the young man. I mean, it was his police chief. He has to live in the country. You know, the rest of us can go there and tell everybody how to do it and then go home. And this guy's got to live there the rest of his life, or so he thought at that time. We were conscious throughout the Vietnam War of blood and guts pictures. I know we've been accused of shooting bloody, as the term was at that time. I never issued any such instructions. If somebody felt that that's the way they had to shoot to get a story on the air, why, that was their own decision. It wasn't mine, and I don't think it was. There weren't any official orders not to to shoot bloody or not to, but we did get a lot of complaints, like a lady from California once wrote me, and there were a number in this vein. Why, oh why, Mr. Lauer, do you have to show those awful bloody Vietnam War pictures every night? Well, actually, we didn't show them every night because we didn't have them to show every night. We would have shown them, probably, if we'd had them that often. But when you did show pictures like that, such as the evacuation of a soldier, or another one that I've got in the collection, I have is a medical evac thing where there's a Viet Cong guy with his legs and arms shot off, mine, I guess. We showed that, and people, even today when they see it.
You can come out here whenever you're ready.
Okay.
I'm right. Cool. Yeah, good. Right.
Well, we better get on to the next subject.
Okay.
Anyway, there were complaints from public. Once I had to appear before, I guess it was the Milton Eisenhower Commission, inquiring into violence on television. They were really mainly interested in violence in fictional programs. But they included news, and I had to make a year's survey. I got somebody on the staff to make a year's survey. And there really wasn't much that much violence or that much blood and guts on our news. But when people see it on television, is a very personal instrument. And you see it at home, it makes a bigger impression on you. And people had a tendency to think they were seeing it more often. So we better get on to your next subject.
Well, that's all right. I'm sure Ron can last a second. Just wanted to know, us to know he's around.
But, all right. Okay, go ahead.
Maybe we can come back to this, but I would be very interested, and I know John would, if you would say something about the particular subject that is of interest is, I would think, is anything that you can provide by way of detail that you recall from the 1960 campaign and perhaps particularly the second debate between Kennedy and Nixon. But if perhaps you could begin by explaining what you were doing, what your position was in 1960.
In 1960, I was the bureau chief for NBC News in Washington. I was also the executive producer of the convention and election coverage that year. When the debates came along, though, I was not the executive producer of that. I guess the one that there was a pool basis that year. CBS did the first one in Chicago, and NBC did the second one, which originally was scheduled for Cleveland, but there was some question about did the NBC station in Cleveland have adequate technical facilities, and also a question about candidates' schedules. So it was moved to Washington. I wasn't in on those negotiations. I didn't do any of the negotiations. But at any rate, my job was a timekeeper for the for that debate. And this was a system of a green light, amber light, red light. We had rigged up. Candidates could see it. You know, they had 2 or 3 minutes for their answers, so you had a 30 seconds before, 15 seconds before, and then a red light when they're finished. And the moderator had those. I guess the moderator had those, not the candidates. At any rate, I think the interesting part, though, is what happened when the two candidates came in to the WRC, the NBC owned station in Washington. The Kennedy people came in first. They arrived probably an hour before the debate. And they had a feeling that as, well, one, they knew that they had won the first debate, at least in the eyes of people who saw it on television, and they knew that they'd gotten a break on the thing because of the poor way that Nixon showed up. And they thought that NBC was going to do something to even things up and to give Nixon a break in that second debate. So Bobby and Jack and Pierre Salinger and I suppose Ted Sorensen and the whole Kennedy retinue walked into that studio about 6:30 and they said, "It's too cold. It's a Nixon studio." And Lefferts McClellan, the chief engineer at that time, had figured, well, I'll have it this cold right at the start, and the lights, when they're on, it will gradually warm it up, and here it will be at the right temperature, and toward the end of the 60 minutes, or hour and a half, or whatever it was, it will be a little warm. See, Nixon likes a cold studio, because he sweats rather profusely. And Jack Kennedy, he could perform in any studio, but he just didn't have it hot. He was a hot weather guy, liked the sun. So, well, they argued about that. Well, what could you do? I mean, you couldn't turn the heaters on all of a sudden. Then they wanted to see the lenses. So they went, first, Jack Kennedy stood at his lectern, and Bobby went in and had the director, I believe it was a guy named Bob Doyle, show him every lens on every camera. Then Jack moved over to Nixon's lectern, and they showed him every lens change there. Then Jack went in the control room, and Bobby went out and stood at each of the two positions. And they showed Jack the thing. And when Nixon came in, he couldn't care less what the arrangements were. They had what the waiting room was called, the green room. He went up to the green room, a nice little office they had fitted out for him. Sat down, rested with his people, Herb Klein probably, and didn't seem interested in what was going on in the studio at all. But the Kennedys were really on their toes. That was the interesting part of it, I think. I don't know. I think that debate turned out pretty even. My recollection of the evening is that they spent a lot of time arguing about Kamoy and Matsu in that one. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it produced any great thing, but those are my impressions of it. The timing went along pretty well. At one point, we had to fall back on a watch when the lights went out or something. So we used a stopwatch or something. instead of an automatic timer.
What do the networks think about putting that much airtime and prime time over on those public issues?
Well, they had done this because, Frank Stanton and later Bobby Sarnoff at NBC had taken the lead in issuing this invitation. Some people will tell you, and this sounds reasonable to me, although I didn't hear it discussed at that time, I mean, in the inner councils I didn't hear it discussed, is that all the networks were so anxious to get the quiz scandals eradicated in the minds of the public. The quiz scandals had been, a year before? I think they'd been in 59, hadn't they? That they wanted to do a lot of different things in the public service area. So that was, I'm sure that was in Frank Stanton's thinking. And he was, it's hard to say who issued the first invitation. CBS always claimed Frank Stanton did. But whoever did it, why? And it was a good thing to do. I think the debates are fine. I think Carter's going to lose this year because if he doesn't participate, I think public opinion will put him down for it.
Do you think that, did you watch the first debate yourself?
Oh, yes, of course. I watched them all.
And
I watched that one on a monitor.
Yeah, and
yes, I did.
What about as an expert from inside? What was your perception of the way those two candidates performed?
Well, I thought Kennedy was the better of the two. Nixon really looked bad. I show excerpts of it today in some lectures I do. And I've got one of them with me here. And he was ghostly pale. He was perspiring. He had on a black suit. In the black suit and his white skin, he'd had Ev Hart, who was an advertising man on the agencies, make him up. CBS offered him professional makeup, and he rejected it. But he looked white. I don't know what they say they put a Lazy Boy on him or 5 o'clock shadow or something like that.
Yeah.
It didn't seem to work very well. And this Frank Stanton, who was sort of an amateur designer, Frank Stanton likes blacks and whites, not much grays. He likes very modern type things. And that studio in Chicago. Yeah.
Oh, I'm recording an interview.
Oh,
so if you just hold it, thanks.
The studio was sort of that cinder block thing painted black or white or whatever. So the whole thing was, and if you look at the cutaways that Nixon was done, have you read that chapter in The Great Debates? By Dick Yoakam and Herb Seltz. That's the most detailed thing I've ever seen on it. And I think they're pretty accurate on it. They had a faculty grant and they went around and talked to everybody afterwards.
But you were talking a second ago before we got banged about Paley and his...
Oh, Paley?
You said
Frank Stanton. Well, yeah. Frank Stanton, the studio was kind of modern design. And that sort of helped the whole blacks and whites thing. But besides that, Nixon just looked uncomfortable. And Kennedy looked very cool. He'd had a coat of tan from being up in Hyannisport. He looked fine.
Do you have a perception that first debate really did have a demonstrable impact? And
yeah, I think it did. I don't think there's any one thing in most campaigns. There's more than one thing that's responsible for a victory, and it's hard in a campaign that was that close, 115,000 popular vote and mm-hmm. 50 or a swing of 30 electoral votes perhaps. It's hard to say that was the only thing that did it, or the first debate. The first debate was terribly important because it gave Kennedy momentum at a time that he needed it badly, in which people were making up their minds. Jim Farley said Nixon never got up off the floor after the first debate. But there were some other things that were important too. I talked a little bit about them yesterday. One was when Jack Kennedy tackled his problem of Catholicism, appearing before the ministers in Houston. That was very important. And arguing that if a Catholic can be president, then 40 million American Catholics have lost their birthright the day they're baptized. And then the second one was when Bobby suggested to him that he call Mrs. Coretta King in Atlanta after Martin Luther King Jr. had been thrown in jail for some sort of public demonstration and saying, I'll work to get your husband out of jail. And I think that endeared him to the blacks, of course. And while Nixon didn't figure to get many black votes, why, I think the blacks got more enthusiastic after that and not only worked, but registered.
How much of a radio audience